Hello, everybody, and welcome to the history of actor training in the British Drama School, the second one this week. Forgive me for overwhelming you, having been absent for a while. Just wanted to get a few things down and out. I should probably say at the beginning of these podcasts rather than at the end, partly because I wonder how many people make it to the end. But if you're listening to this podcast and you'd like to support it, there are several ways you can do that. My favourite is probably just to receive an email. It's really nice when that happens. My email address is robertprice1869@gmail.com. Another way you can support the show is to leave a review via Apple or however people leave reviews. And thirdly, on the Buzzsprout site that hosts this podcast, there's a love button. You don't have to love it or a like button, where you can make a donation if you felt that was something you wanted to do. If you did, that would be brilliant. Thank you. Or just listen, of course, is the best thing of all. So this week, I wanted to look at the history of the translation of Stanislavski's texts. And the reason I want to do that is because we're sort of heading towards a discussion about certainly one and possibly two acting teachers who taught at the Drama Centre, who had a big influence on the way that acting is taught in actor training. I think it's very important to make a distinction between those things. Maybe it's very, very obvious, but I certainly have sometimes felt teaching at drama schools that there's too much, perhaps, competition between the different departments in the drama school, and perhaps a sort of a hierarchy, which I think is probably unhelpful within the body and voice and tech within the technique, actually, of the actor. So I think a synthesis is probably what we're after, and sometimes departmental divisions discourage that synthesis. So I certainly think that everybody who teaches in a drama school is an actor teacher, is teaching acting. But of course, what's tended to be the case for some time now is that there's been a department called the acting department, who teaches those things which are perhaps teachable about the technique of acting itself, as opposed from the techniques of the voice, the techniques of body and movement, of use, of singing. Some schools have other departments too. So the history of acting teaching in the British Drama School has tended to center around the teaching of the Russian director and theorist and writer and all-round cool chap, Konstantin Stanislavski, in a fairly complicated way. And it is quite a complicated story. Some of you may be very familiar with it. Some of you less so. I think when I was a young actor, I had a sense of the name of Stanislavski. I had a sort of a sense of the American method, perhaps in a slightly a daft way. I think the idea of sort of deep immersion in character was essentially what I thought the American method was. And that's a part of it, but it's a much more complicated thing than that. But I know that when I decided I wanted to be an actor, I bought three books that I still have, actually. One of them was Cicely Berry's book, Text and the Actor. Don't know why I bought that. I guess it was just on the bookshelves. This was in the Books Upstairs in Dublin, a bookshop that I hope is still there. So I bought Text and the Actor by Cicely Berry. I bought Liz Pisk's book, which I think is called The Actor and His Body, I think, or something along those lines. And I bought An Actor Prepares, Stanislavski's book, which I read with fascination, and I suspect, like a lot of actors, something close to bewilderment. I was taken with the book. I was persuaded by it in a sort of rhetorical sense, but I didn't really know what to do with what I was reading when I was going in to rehearsals the following day. The reason why this is so important in terms of the history of actor training in the British Drama School, and I don't think this is very complicated, is after its publication in England, in English, in I think 1937, which in itself was a fairly crucial period for the British Drama School, because Michael Chekhov was in Dartington Hall, Michel Saint-Denis had set up and was running the London Theatre Studio, so things were changing. But after that, people, of course, would get An Actor Prepares and read it, and it influenced people. It influenced the way people taught, it influenced what people thought about acting. The sort of history, the accepted history, should we call it, the received history, perhaps, and I'm sure there's some accuracy in this, I'm not contesting it, but just saying it is a received history, is that unlike Russia, of course, but also unlike America, acting training didn't really settle into any sort of coherent form in the British Drama School until surprisingly late, sometime in the 1960s, the foundation of the Drama Centre being a key moment, although Vladimir Mirodan has written about Harold Lang teaching at Central slightly before the foundation of the Drama Centre as the first class. And I think other people would say other things. We've heard on this podcast someone like Alan Stanford saying that his training was Stanislavski-based. And we were talking last week about the degree to which Michel Saint-Denis' schools either side of the Second World War were influenced by Stanislavski. And I'm sure lots of smart, clever people in the British theatre were reading Stanislavski's books, were hearing about the work. I'm sure some of them had travelled to Russia to see the Moscow Arts Theatre or seen the work of the Prague group, which toured to Britain, sort of an offshoot of the Moscow Arts Theatre. I mean, I'm sure people were curious. But essentially, the text they would have used was the translation of An Actor Prepares and then a subsequent translation called Building a Character. So I think it's useful to know quite what that text is. Luckily, we're blessed in Britain, or were blessed, by having a really remarkable man called Jean Benedetti, who was very much a creature of the drama school, and specifically of Rose Bruford. So I suppose, in a way, we might want to dedicate this the episode of this podcast to Rose Bruford. An interesting drama school, a drama school set up by a woman, Rose Bruford, and one at which I've been teaching a little bit for the past year. So I've got to know Rose Bruford a little tiny bit. Been on my mind, I think, partly because, interestingly, in this rather difficult year, Rose Bruford has done rather well in the National Student Survey. The National Student Survey is a survey that comes out every year. It's been running since 2005, I think. And it asks students a number of questions about their BA courses. So the NSS survey is carried out on final year students of all BA courses in Britain. And because the vast majority of drama school core courses, three-year courses, are BAs, that means that those courses are surveyed and those results are published. This year's results, I haven't looked at all of them, although I've looked at quite a few of them, and they make quite sort of unsurprising reading in lots of cases, in that there's been a slight decline of student satisfaction. I had a little look around, and that's been repeated across all universities, all BA courses. There's an average decline of 8% in terms of overall student satisfaction. I think that's unsurprising in the context of COVID. What's kind of more interesting, looking closely, so digging into the NSS results for drama schools, there are several things that are curious. Many schools seem to more or less echo that average. A little bit less satisfied would be the sort of the basic story. But a couple of schools have done very well. The arts educational schools have done very well and have gone to the top, as far as I can make out, of drama school satisfaction. That's interesting because arts ed has been led for some time now by a fairly innovative director. Although I guess that would include both the BA acting and BA musical theatre courses. Rose Bruford did really well, actually, increased its percentage. And some schools, notably my old favourite drama school, Lambda, did did rather poorly, with a really significant decline in student satisfaction, some 40%. The reason for that, I'm sure, is complicated and perhaps will be discussed in other places soon. But thinking about Rose Bruford and Jean Benedetti, I thought before I read you Jean Benedetti's paper, the paper is called A History of Stanislavski in Translation, and it's a fairly substantial paper. I think, as I mentioned in the last podcast, there's an even more substantial book about Stanislavski in Translation and Other Things by Sharon Carnicki, a really wonderful read, a really brilliant book. But I like this paper because although it's considerable and detailed, it's not impossible to read on a podcast. So I'm going to read you Jean Benedetti's A History of Stanislavski in Translation. Just before I do that, I thought maybe I'd read you a little bit about Jean Benedetti. Maybe I'll just read you the whole of his obituary in The Guardian, because it's really fascinating. So the obituary is from Friday the 20th of April, 2012, so 10 years ago. And it says, Jean Benedetti, who has died aged 81, combined several theatrical careers in one. The former principal of Rose Bruford College of Theatre and Performance in Sidcup, Kent, he was also a dramatist for stage and television, a translator of French, Italian and German plays, including those of Brecht, an actor and director, and a scholar of the seminal theorist of modern acting, Konstantin Stanislavski. Jean's translation of Stanislavski's autobiography, My Life in Art, was followed by a best-selling handbook for acting students, Stanislavski, An Introduction, 1982, and Stanislavski, A Biography, 1988. The first and only such account in English, now sadly out of print, which he expanded and revised over the years. It's quite easy to get on Amazon or similar. For Stanislavski scholars, it was widely known that the trilogy of English language volumes of his writings, translated by Elizabeth Reynolds Hapgood, a fine linguist and academic, but not a theatre scholar, were inaccurate and sorely dated when compared with Stanislavski's work published in Russian. Stanislavski continued to work on his theories until his death in 1938, which meant the volumes, such as An Actor Prepares, were a mistaken representation of what he came to believe about what the actor does in preparation to play a role on stage. Over time, gross misunderstandings grew about Stanislavski and his system, such as the over-limited reliance on psychological approaches that led to the American conception of method acting. Jean spent the latter part of his life trying to correct these through research in Russian archives and examination of Stanislavski's own manuscripts. His short summary, Stanislavski and the Actor, 1998, based on his new findings, would eventually be followed by the long-awaited retranslations from Routledge of Stanislavski's most seminal text, with Jean based on Stanislavski's final Russian manuscripts and published versions, An Actor's Work, A Student Diary, and An Actor's Work on a Role. Though these translations in time may also be contested, they set a new standard in Stanislavski research and research into the process of acting. So that's a really good summary of Jean Benedetti's work. Really significant. I guess we sort of know that a bit, but this is my favourite bit. I don't know why, I just like this. Jean was born in Barking, Essex, as Norman Bennett. Isn't that cool? Jean Benedetti, who's a name I've seen for years, I mean, years and years and years, on books, wonderfully European name. His name is actually Norman Bennett, and he was born, well, I know his name is Jean Benedetti, but his name when he was born was Norman Bennett, from Barking, Essex. In 1965, he changed his name by deed poll to Jean Norman Benedetti, reflecting his loves for things French and Italian, though he used Jean for his work as a writer. From an early age, he was a gifted linguist, fluent in French, German and Spanish, and later Russian. Throughout his life, he divided his time between England and France, where he did most productive writing, in a house in the Dordogne, borrowed from friends. His early education was in music at Newcastle University, but he left before getting a degree in order to work as a teaching assistant in France. Once he decided on a career in theatre, he enrolled at the new Rose Bruford College of Speech and Drama, as it then was, and studied under Bruford herself. Her demanding, disciplined teaching and love of verse and verse speaking engaged him. For Jean, acting was almost effortless. He was a gifted student and repeatedly won prizes. After graduating, he worked in rep theatres across the country and in the West End, where in 1965 he stepped into Dudley Moore's part in Beyond the Fringe. Well, that's... how cool is that? He graduated to work in radio and television, both acting and script writing. I suppose what I'm grasping towards is just the feeling that maybe we Jean Benedetti's a bit underregarded. Is that a thing you can say? So for me, I thought he was simply a sort of academic translator. I didn't realise how much of a man of the theatre and indeed of the drama school he was. So this is somebody who studied at drama school and then ran drama schools, about to hear. From 1964 to 1974, he worked intermittently at Laurence Olivier's newly established National Theatre at London's Old Vic, so this is when the National was at the Old Vic, where he was advisor on European repertoire to Kenneth Tynan, Olivier's literary manager. He also brought European plays to the attention of British publishers. In 1970, Jean returned to Rose Bruford College as principal and stayed as head until his retirement in 1987. That's a long old time to be the head of a drama school, not an easy job. Throughout the rest of the 70s and early 80s, specialist drama schools in the UK were trying to gain credibility and sustainability as educational institutions. Jean had studied to be both an actor and a teacher, a double role that Bruford felt was important to pioneer at the college. Yes, this is one of the curious things about Rose Bruford, is that this relationship between teaching and acting was something she felt was very important. I'd always understood in a very dim way or guessed that that was something to do with employment, or perhaps to do with... it was good if teachers were also able to act, especially teachers of theatre. But still within the course at Rose Bruford, within the BA, which I've taught on a little bit, are some ideas that actually teaching is an aspect of acting, of what it means to be an actor. That's Rose Bruford's idea. It's a more elegant, thoughtful thing than I'd realised. It's no longer the case, by the way, that students at Rose Bruford train to be teachers and actors. I don't know when that changed. I'm not sure when that happened. And I don't know whether people like Gary Oldman, who we're about to hear about, also trained as teachers. I don't know. Maybe somebody could let me know. I'm sure there are some people who listen to this podcast. Maybe we should do a podcast about Rose Bruford and Rose Bruford School. The connection between the practice of dramatic technique and the intellectual rigour of higher education was a natural link for Jean to make. The college became the first British institution with university status to offer a BA in acting rather than just in dramatic literature and theatre history. So Rose Bruford pioneers the BA in acting. There are an astonishingly large number of BAs in acting now. Again, I looked this up recently, and it's in the region of 70 courses in the UK offer BAs in acting. The number of drama schools has tended to hover around 20. So partly that's because those institutions have sort of multiplied slightly, but also now universities are offering, rather than BAs in drama, BAs in acting. This is a fairly new thing. I think we could call this the sort of the deregulation of the drama school and its growing. The implications of that fact, in terms of what it means to train to be an actor, perhaps what it means to train for employment as an actor, I think is something that hasn't really been fully considered. There have been some articles in The Stage, but anyway, the first BA acting was at Rose Bruford. BA degrees for technical theatre training and community theatre work soon followed. A pattern was set that other drama schools would eventually follow. Jean presided over the college during a golden period that produced a new breed of British stage and screen actors, including Gary Oldman. Jean's later publications included David Garrick and The Birth of Modern Theatre, and a book about the history of acting from ancient times to modern, The Art of the Actor, both written while he was working through his grand Russian project, the complete Stanislavski. He enjoyed diversions like these. I worked with him as his editor at Methuen and followed him many years later to become principal of Rose Bruford College. I remember him telling me in animated fashion about the wonderful letters exchanged between Anton Chekhov and his actor wife Olga Knipper. Now that would be a terrific book, I said. Several months later, an impeccably translated manuscript arrived on my desk. Dear writer, dear actress, the love letters of Anton Chekhov and Olga Knipper, published in 1997. Got it. It's wonderful. A witty and gregarious man, Zhang could become fierce, narrowing his eyes and adopting an imperious tone when faced with bad acting or poor scholarship about the technique of acting. Having set new standards in theatre and actor training, his books generated new approaches to the field of performance studies. He refined how we write and think about performance. Jean had no close surviving relatives. His circle of friends went back to his school days. Jean Norman Benedetti, theatre and acting historian, born 30th of December 1930, died 27th of March 2012. I'm just thinking now, reading that, I may have more books in my bookshelf in my room where I keep my sort of actor training books by Jean Benedetti than by anybody else. Thank you, Jean Benedetti. So moving on, let's read this paper. So yeah, this is the history of, anyway, I've mentioned it, haven't I? The history of Stanislavski in translation, and important because, once again, we're dealing with our key texts. So one of our key texts. Also, I suppose it's probably worth mentioning that Stanislavski, as somebody who is taught in drama schools or is the centre of the teaching, is under some kind of debate at the moment. And that would be a part of the whole process of decolonizing the conservatoire, decolonizing the drama school. I think that's a perfectly okay debate to have, of course, useful. So let's sort of get down some sort of reasonably detailed account of what these texts are that we may be questioning. So Jean Benedetti writes, it's quite a long one. I hope you enjoy it. The history of the Stanislavski system in the West is virtually synonymous with the history of the publication of his writings. For while there's an oral tradition of sorts, particularly in the United States, that tradition must be approached with caution. Many, over the last 60 years, have claimed to be pupils of Stanislavski. Indeed, he once remarked that there were enough so-called pupils to fill his company several times over. There are those, like Boleslavsky and Solovyova, had direct contact with Stanislavski and his working methods, either in the art theatre or the studios. Others lived on the fringe of the art theatre company, picking up hints from friends. So we'll see how we go, but he seems to be dubious about the American tradition, which begins with Boleslavsky and Maria Uspenskaya. There were many partial and not always accurate accounts of the system in circulation in Moscow as early as 1918. Though vigorously attacked by Vakhtangov, these were sometimes perpetuated by such famous figures as Komisarzewski, that's Theodore, I suppose, rather than his sister. Yet it's important to ask, even when the credentials of one of Stanislavski's pupils are impeccable, at what period they worked with him and which particular version of the system they learned. Stanislavski's working methods evolved constantly over the years, and what was true for 1924 would not necessarily be true for 1934. Time and age have thus taken their toll. And now, quite frequently, the Stanislavski tradition is carried forward by pupils of pupils, each of whom presents a particular standpoint, which may never have been consciously tested against the corpus of Stanislavski's writings. Then there's the relentless internecine war the proponents of different versions of the systems carry on among themselves, of which the most spectacular example is the conflict between Stella Adler and Lee Strasberg, each claiming to be the true guardian of the master's thought, as though it were the Holy Grail. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's certainly perhaps true of Stella Adler, but I think Lee Strasberg, rather sort of magnificently, used to say that what he was teaching really was Strasberg rather than Stanislavski. But anyway, of course, these kinds of debates exist. Most students of the system, however, do not have contact with an oral tradition of any kind. They rely for their knowledge of Stanislavski's methods on four books, three of which, My Life in Art, An Actor Prepares, and Building a Character, were originally published in the United States. These texts form the basis for the study of the Stanislavski system in theatre schools and conservatoires, universities and colleges throughout the West. It should therefore be essential that such texts are scholarly and accurate, so that pupils and teachers may not be led down false paths, and the claims of the oral tradition can be properly verified. Unfortunately, the currently available translations are often at best dubious and at worst harmfully misleading. How is it that works of such cardinal importance come to us in so questionable a form? The root of the problem lies in Stanislavski's own personality. He had a very low opinion of his capacity as a writer. His experience at school and later at the Lazarev Institute had been unhappy. He had to cheat to get through his Latin exams and considered himself an academic failure. At 18, he chose not to go to university and went into the family textile business instead. In time, he became head of the firm, which he ran with great efficiency, if little enthusiasm. I think it's in Benedetti's book about Stanislavski that he says, in Russia, sort of Stanislavski is a bit like the Rothschilds in America, fabulously rich. I mean, really from one of the richest families of all. Although he had no pretension, but brilliant that he cheated to pass his Latin exams and was an academic failure. Although he had no pretensions to literary gifts, Stanislavski nonetheless wrote every day. He confided his thoughts on the theatre in his notebooks, which he kept continuously from the age of 14, and in which he analysed his successes and failures as an actor and director in detail. These were, of course, purely private jottings. However, once he had created the system, how was he to convey his ideas, which were often attacked without really being understood or simply dismissed as crackpot, unless through the written and published word? From 1906 onwards, he made many attempts to get his ideas down on paper. By the time of his departure for France and the US in 1922, when Michel Saint-Denis sees him, the cupboards in his flat at 6 Leontievsky Lane were crammed with drafts and manuscripts of books which he'd started in a mood of enthusiasm but abandoned, sometimes almost immediately, sometimes, as in the case of various tendencies in theatre art, after years of effort. His critic and friend Nikolai Efros maintained in a monograph published in 1918 that a book outlining the system had already been completed, but that Stanislavski refused to allow it to be printed. This reticence to publish was due not only to a lack of confidence, but also to Stanislavski's constant awareness of the provisional nature of his findings. Not only was it difficult for him to express his ideas coherently and clearly, but he also realised that what he'd written was no longer corresponded to his actual practice. Left to himself, Stanislavski would never have published anything. The books which appeared in his lifetime, My Life in Art and An Actor Prepares, were only finished with the help of others. He was always dependent on someone else, a colleague, a pupil, even, if need be, someone who happened to be around and free at the time. And it was this reliance on others that ultimately opened the door to the misrepresentation and distortion of his thought. The next section is called The Economic Imperative. Okay, so there we go. So Stanislavski, this name that's still, I think, uncontestably the biggest name in terms of how we think about the theory of how to act well. Stanislavski was a messy and disorganized, reluctant, maybe not even particularly competent writer. So there's a problem there, the relationship between what he thought, what he was doing, and his ability to write it out. The economic imperative. In 1923, Stanislavski needed money, or more precisely, dollars. His son Igor had tuberculosis and required treatment in Switzerland. Stanislavski had lost his immense fortune in the revolution, the Russian Revolution, and now lived off his own salary and his wife, Lilina's. The ruble had no value on the international money market, and all treatment would have to be paid in hard currency. Stanislavski hoped that the American tour, which had begun in January, would provide him with funds. But in the event, while the company had a success d'estime, taking barely covered costs, he would have to make money elsewhere. In January, so it went really well, but didn't make much money. This is interesting, isn't it? So I think where we're going here is that really the entry of Stanislavski into America and also into Britain is really based on his need to raise money for his sick son. It's rather poetic, isn't it? In January, Stanislavski received what looked like a promising offer in the form of a commission to write a film script. He regarded the cinema as essentially suitable for large-scale historical subjects that would give popular audiences some sense of the past, and so decided to adapt two historical dramas by Tolstoy, Tsar Fyodor Ivanovich and The Death of Ivan the Terrible, both of which had been in the Moscow Art Theatre repertoire. The Russian people would be the hero. Probably go down well with them, with the revolution. Unfortunately, he counted without the innate vulgarity of the movie moguls who, for their part, saw the Russian people as mere backgrounds to a romance between two young lovers who did not figure anywhere in Tolstoy's original scripts and would have to be written in. Stanislavski abandoned the project in disgust. The only other possibility for making money was a book. Maurice Guest, who had organised the tour, and his publicity assistant, Oliver Saylor, were convinced that given the huge reputation Stanislavski enjoyed, a book by him was bound to be a runaway success. But what kind of a book? And when would he have the time to write it? He was acting, rehearsing, and managing the tour. It could only be written in odd moments. Also, he needed someone to help him. In Russia, he always had his faithful friend and collaborator, Lyubov Gurevich, herself a specialist in the history of the theatre and of acting, who was there in the United States. As luck would have it, he had at his side every day an émigré critic and designer, Alexander Kuransky, who served as his interpreter and guide. Kuransky maintained that it was he who was instrumental in helping Stanislavski put My Life in Art together. His claims are difficult to verify, however. In his review of the book, Boleslavsky, who was close to Stanislavski throughout his time in New York, I think Boleslavsky was Polish, if I made that up? Anyway, expressed his surprise that Stanislavski had not acknowledged Kuransky's contribution. Stanislavski himself only mentions Kuransky twice in his letters home, briefly, and then gets the name wrong, calling him Kuransky. Stanislavski's original idea was to write a book on the system. Kuransky claims to have put some order into Stanislavski's confused notes, which consisted of fragments of text which Stanislavski had cut with his scissors and pasted into exercise books. Whether these fragments were the manuscript Efros referred to in 1918 is not certain. Kuransky put together a text of about 100 pages, to which Stanislavski added supplementary passages. This was sent to Little, Brown and Company in Boston and immediately turned down. Well, imagine that, turning that down. Stanislavski then considered writing a history of the art theatre, the Moscow Art Theatre, which would contain an exposition of his philosophy. This, too, was turned down. What the publishers wanted was a book for the general public, a popular autobiography full of anecdotes about his life and childhood, precisely the kind of book Stanislavski detested. He had made his views clear in 1911. Well, I'm going to get to be Stanislavski. Brilliant. This is Stanislavski. I won't do a Russian accent. I have been asked to write my autobiography, but I have resolutely refused to do so, for nothing is more boring than the autobiography of an actor. I shall be asked, above all, to write irritating stock phrases like, I felt within me a passion for art inherited from my grandmother, who was a famous French actress. I shall be asked on every line to write. I played this or that. I was a success or a failure. They wrote this about me. This eternal declension, I, my, me, is particularly distasteful, and actors should be banned from talking about themselves and from endlessly trotting out the fact that people liked them. Oh, I like that. This eternal declension, I, my, me. There are a number of actors. There's one very highly regarded actor of Beckett, whom I really struggle to enjoy reading about or reading what they write, because they're caught in what Stanislavski here describes as this eternal declension. I, my, me. Very good. Going to use that. Yet the actor, more than anyone else, should write. Why? Because his art lives and dies with him. Just think. If actors had made less of a mystery of their art and had shared their secrets with those who come after them, we should have established the laws of art true artists yearn for long since. We would chatter less and talk less nonsense. I think he's quite a good writer, if this is the authentic voice of Stanislavski. Nonetheless, Jean Benedetti carries on to say, if Stanislavski wanted money, it looked as if he would have to write high-class gossip of some sort. Kuransky, by his own account, drafted an outline, using Stanislavski's diaries and notebooks, which were sent to Boston, and this time accepted. The contract for My Life in Art was signed at the beginning of May. It stipulated a length of 60,000 words and a delivery date of the 1st of September. Stanislavski set to work with his usual prodigious energy. He dictated the book to his secretary, who typed it straight into the machine. He wrote out his... This is a quote from her. Olga. He wrote out his text first of all in longhand, then dictated it to me in a free and relaxed manner. Then he would revise what he had done, and I would type up a fair copy. Often he would revise it again, and I would type it up once more. It was agreed that the days we played Chekhov and he was not needed, and sometimes after the third act of The Lower Depths, in which I was an extra, I would go to his hotel to take dictation. Armed with a portable typewriter, I made my way from 58th to 56th Street, where he was staying, and we would get down to work. K.S. didn't know what the word tired meant. We wrote page after page, at 2 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes later, when he was still fresh and ready to go on, he would stop nonetheless and say, "Pardon me, what time is it? I'm sorry, we must stop. It's a pity, but we must." The same relentless pace was maintained on the boat, which took the company back to Europe. Stanislavski had decided to spend the summer break in Germany rather than make the long journey all the way back to Russia. His family joined him in Freiburg, near the Swiss frontier. From there, it was easy for him to cross over and see Igor, who was in a clinic in Vernwald. From the doctors, he learned that his son would need at least 4 or 5 years' treatment, and since the tour had made a loss of $25,000, it was urgent to finish the book. Unfortunately, he'd already used up his allotted 60,000 words and not even reached the creation of the art theatre, the heart of the book, as far as he was concerned. He sent off the chapters he'd managed to complete and wired a request for a further 60,000 words, which he got. It's pretty moving, isn't it? He's trying to save his son, really. Stanislavski's eyes were now giving him trouble, so that he could not work more than 3 hours a day. By the beginning of September, he was back in rehearsal, preparing a new repertoire for the second tour. Back in New York, he continued to write as hard as he could, in streetcars, in the intervals at the theatre, in the street, and when he was able, in a quiet room that had been especially set aside for him, in New York City Library. Do New Yorkers know about this? Do New Yorkers know that there was a room set aside for Stanislavski's writing in the New York City Library? They probably do, don't they? Do you? Any of you listening? It's cool. But he was making little headway and becoming increasingly worried by the penalty clause in his contract, which would require him to return part of the advance if he missed his deadline, money that had been spent long since. The translation was made chapter by chapter, as each was completed, by a young American, J.J. Robbins, who had apparently been suggested to the publisher by Kuransky. Robbins had published a translation of Lermontov, which was highly considered, and he was, in consequence, or so Stanislavski was told, in great demand. In his CV, Robbins claims to have been a pupil of the great Russian actor Alexander Lensky, whom Stanislavski admired. To have studied dance in Petersburg, to have worked with Boleslavsky, to have been Stanislavski's assistant at Moscow Arts, a glittering career. Strange, therefore, that Stanislavski speaks of him as a complete stranger. That's obviously Jean Benedetti getting curious about frauds there. By April 1924, the second tour was drawing to its close, and the book was still not finished. On the contrary, it was still growing. Stanislavski was obliged to ask for another 30,000 words in order to be able to finish, but at 150,000 words, the book was 2.5 times as long as originally planned, and the publishers finally lost patience. They sent a telegram demanding that the final chapters be dispatched within 2 weeks, otherwise the contract would be cancelled and Stanislavski would have to return the advance. Stanislavski was devastated. Kuransky, it would seem, took charge, drafted the paragraph which begins, "There is no art which has dot demand virtuosity himself," and got the manuscript off on time. My Life in Art was published at the end of April 1924. On the 17th of May, Stanislavski set sail for Europe. Holding the book in his hand, he could only remark that the binding was superior to the contents. Witty? Fortunately for him, he spoke no English and therefore did not realise the barbarous patois into which his words had been translated. His own natural, spontaneous style, essentially a spoken style, had been rendered in a language no native speaker has ever used or would wish to use. Instead, the voice of a great artist, an experienced professional. Robbins gives a mixture of quaintness and naivety, in a language known only to a translator in a hurry. Certainly, Stanislavski was something of an idealist, who, to our more cynical modern ears, can sound impossibly high-minded. Such language was, however, natural to those brought up, like him, in the traditions of the 19th century intelligentsia. His friend and contemporary, Shalyapin, spoke of his art in much the same high-sounding terms. Towards a Russian edition. My Life in Art. To my shame, it's the book I haven't read. I do, though, know something, some little tiny thing of the work of translator, having worked with Arena Brown a little bit on her translation of the essays of Mariah Knebel. A curious thing to do. Anyway, Towards a Russian Edition. Stanislavski's comment on the book was no mere quip. It was, as far as he was concerned, a botched job and had to be reworked. On the Majestic, he once more took his scissors and started to cut up the Russian typescript, rearranging it as a preliminary to a thoroughgoing revision. In the Soviet Union, the book would inevitably acquire a political significance that would have been inaccessible to an American public. It would be less a biography than an apologia pro vita sua, a justification of his aesthetic philosophy, which had been violently attacked by the avant-garde and artistic left since the revolution. Sharon Carnicki is very good on this stuff, by the way, that as well as other things, Stanislavski is writing in a post-revolutionary period. There's a huge amount of politics going on. I think I'm right in thinking that Benedetti doesn't go into great detail about that in this paper, but there's a little bit of it there. Well, here we go. The Art Theatre had been virtually driven abroad in 1922 by the hostility it provoked as a remnant of a bygone bourgeois age. The Russian edition would be the first counterblast in Stanislavski's campaign to re-establish both the theatre's reputation and the validity of realism as an aesthetic and social philosophy. He worked with a sense of urgency, and by January 1925 was able to announce to a friend that the revised version was complete. This, however, was not the case, and he continued to work on the book throughout the whole of 1925 and up to March 1926. In the spring of 1925, he submitted the manuscript to Mirimirovich Danchenko, who suggested certain changes, particularly to passages concerning the theatre's relationship to Chekhov. These Stanislavski incorporated into the text unaltered. Mirimirovich and Mrs. Gudovich also corrected a number of historical errors in the interests of complete authenticity. Though some chronological errors still remained, Lyubov Gudovich, with Stanislavski's full permission, discreetly edited and cut the text, but also indicated places she thought could benefit from some expansion. And it was she who suggested the penultimate chapter, Departure and Return, in which, for the first time, Stanislavski publicly states his views on recent developments in the theatre and the avant-garde. Typically, he expresses himself in general and purely artistic terms, and avoids any kind of overt political polemic. This chapter was not written until the end of February 1926. It is probable that Stanislavski based it on a chapter he had intended for the American edition, which took the form of an open letter to a young director, doubtless Meyerhold, but which he had withdrawn at the last minute. According to J.J. Robbins, the translation of this chapter was already on its way to the publisher when Stanislavski sent a telegram stopping it. He gave no reason. The first Soviet edition appeared in September 1926 and represented for Stanislavski the only valid version, completely supplanting the American edition, which he did not wish to be translated into other languages under any circumstances. He had expressed this view quite unambiguously in September 1924 in a letter to Karl Kirsten, who had requested permission to bring out a German edition. So again, this is Stanislavski. "I am more than willing to enter into negotiations with you, but wish to make it quite clear that the edition which appeared in the United States was written for an American readership and that I am revising it for the Russian reader. The difference between the two editions is as follows. The first is packed with material which is often of a purely anecdotal nature and was written for an uninformed public. As to the second, i.e. the Russian edition, it is written with a much more serious reader in mind and will go into artistic problems more deeply." Gaston Gallimard received a similar response in 1928 when he suggested a French edition with a preface by Jacques Copeau. The first French edition was, in the event, brought out by another publisher, La Renaissance du Livre, in Brussels, in 1934, with a preface by Copeau. Be interesting to read. I've never read Copeau's preface to My Life in Art. The translators were Nina Gorfinkel and Leon Chancerel. They decided to cut the text, and when their translation was republished in 1950 and a revised edition, it was still in cut form, the justification being that many passages were too Russian. A full French version of Stanislavski's text, which he again revised in 1928, did not appear until 1980 in a translation by Denise Jokers, published by L'Age d'Homme. As to English language publishers, they continue to reprint the rejected 1924 American text, so that after more than 60 years, their readers still do not have access to the text by which Stanislavski wished to be remembered. A new translation is in preparation, but a publication date is not fixed. I wonder if that's Benedetti's translation. Okay, so I'm going to have to look that up. I don't know whether you can yet read an English translation of the Russian version of An Actor Prepares. I feel, my hunch is probably the answer is yes, but I don't know. Good. Anyway, My Life in Art is an important book because it was read in England and people like Saint Denis and other English actors, theatre people talk about it. I'm reading it. But the really important one is, I think, it's fair to say, is An Actor Prepares, which I think in Russian can be sometimes translated as an actor's work on himself or themselves. However complex the story of the writing and publication of My Life in Art may be, it is simplicity itself compared to the convoluted history of the other publications which appeared under Stanislavski's name. Oh, blimey. Okay, I thought that was pretty complex, but okay, here we go. So now let's find out about this. It was not until 1930 that Stanislavski could get down to serious work on his next book, An Actor Prepares. Before leaving the United States, he had reached an agreement with Little, Brown and Company for two further books, the titles of which were unspecified. After his return to Moscow, he could do no more than revise My Life in Art. He was continuously in rehearsal, attempting to conserve the best in the art theatre tradition and adapt it to a post-revolutionary situation. This he did almost unaided, since Nemirovich was absent for 2 years on tour in the United States. So Nemirovich Danchenko went to the US with the Moscow Art Theatre? I didn't know that, while Stanislavski was still in Russia. Interesting. Between 1926 and 1928, Stanislavski staged 9 straight plays, 10 if one counts The Prometheus Bound of Aeschylus, which was abandoned after more than a year's rehearsal, and 4 operas, 2 years, 10 plays, 4 operas. Busy. This period of almost inhuman effort resulted in a heart attack, which he suffered on stage during a gala evening to celebrate the theatre's 30th anniversary. A long convalescence ensued, but by the spring of 1929, he could once more turn his mind to writing his long-projected book on actor training. He had finally opted for a semi-fictional form, The Diary of a Pupil, rather than straightforward exposition. The diary would be written by a young actor, Kostya, the diminutive of Stanislavski's own name, Constantine. In May, no, I didn't know that. There you go, isn't that? There we go. Stupid of me. Of course, Kostya is Constantine. In May 1929, he and his wife, Lilina, journeyed to Badenweiler, where Chekhov had died. His son, Igor, and Olga Knipper, Chekhov's widow, joined them there. As chance would have it, Norman and Elizabeth Hapgood were also in the area. Stanislavski had met the Hapgoods in Washington in 1924 at a reception at the White House. Mrs. Hapgood, who spoke Russian, had been engaged to advise President Coolidge on the correct pronunciation of the names of his Soviet guests. In April, shortly before they met again, she had conveyed him an invitation from the American Laboratory Theatre, founded by Boleslavsky, to spend 8 months in the United States, during which time he would give a series of lectures and practical classes. Norman Hapgood had first made contact with Stanislavski in 1914 when he had suggested an American tour. It was to this small group, quite a cool group though, Olga Knipper, the Hapgoods, and his son Igor. It was to this small group that in July Stanislavski read extracts from The Diary of a Pupil. It was a momentous evening, for it was then that the Hapgoods decided, as it were, to take him up. It's not difficult to picture the situation. There before them they have a man of genius, the Michelangelo of the theatre, as Meyerhold described him, who seems unable to complete the book the world is waiting for. It is their duty, in some sort, to help him. They're well placed to do so. Elizabeth Hapgood can translate the text, and Norman Hapgood, who is a drama critic and an experienced editor, can shape it into a publishable form. At the end of August, the Hapgoods left Badenweiler for Menton. Officially, Stanislavski was supposed to return to the Soviet Union, but he was by no means in good shape. Lilina was apprehensive about his ability to cope with the severe Moscow winter. Susceptible since childhood to flu, Stanislavski had now developed asthma, and any kind of respiratory difficulty merely aggravated the condition of his heart, which was now of twice normal size. Lilina applied for permission to extend their stay abroad. This was granted, and in November they took up residence in a modest villa not far from the Hapgoods. The Hapgoods had not been idle in the interim. They had found a potential publisher, Yale University Press, and had reached agreements with several leading American papers for serialization before publication. Work did not, however, begin immediately. Stanislavski was busy with the production plan for the ill-fated Othello, thrown on in defiance of his wishes by a desperate art theatre. It was not until March 1930 that he got down to serious work on the book, which was now called An Actor's Work on Himself. Stanislavski and the Hapgoods adopted a simple working method. Mrs. Hapgood would translate Stanislavski's text, while Norman Hapgood, with his red pencil, would cut and edit the translation and make suggestions which his wife would then translate into Russian for Stanislavski's approval. For the first time in his life, Stanislavski was writing to a strict routine with nothing else to think about. What was his source of income at the time? He did not know himself. As he wrote to his secretary, Ripsey, he was up to his ears in debt, but had received, he did not know from where, 13,000 rubles. The truth was that unknown to him, Mrs. Hapgood had set up a Stanislavski fund in the United States and had persuaded rich friends, including Dorothy Elmhurst, famous as the moving spirit behind Dartington Hall, and a devotee of Michael Chekhov, to contribute. Well, there we go, never knew that. An account had been opened at Lloyd's Bank in Menton containing $7,500. It's also almost certain that the Hapgoods supported him discreetly with their own money. I'm sitting here reading this and I'm thinking the Hapgood translation is so criticised that on some sort of strange emotional level I sort of don't like Elizabeth Hapgood, and now I'm feeling really, really moved by her support of Stanislavski. So there we go. Sorry, Elizabeth Hapgood. But we'll find out more. In April 1930, the moment seemed right to put matters on a legal footing. On the 22nd of April, Stanislavski signed a letter which was typed on paper under the letterhead Villa Bella, Menton, France. On the following day, the American consul in Nice, George Armstrong, signed a certificate of execution of document which gave the letter the force of a legal contract under United States and international law. The letter was perhaps the most significant Stanislavski ever signed. Under its terms, Elizabeth Hapgood was granted power of attorney to act on his behalf. She was authorised to negotiate the publication of An Actor Prepares and other unspecified works, four in number, either in book or serial form in papers and journals. She was also authorised to negotiate motion picture rights and was empowered to recover any money she might have spent as underwriting and to receive royalties on behalf of Stanislavski and his heirs. At the same time, Stanislavski took a further decision which was to have far-reaching consequences. Against his better judgment and that of Norman Hapgood, he decided to bring out an actor's work on himself in two parts. The reason for this decision was purely practical. The typeface of the Soviet publishing house Academia was very large, and if the book appeared in a single volume, it would run to an unmanageable 1,200 pages. So the reason why the book appears in two parts is because the typeface of Academia, a Soviet, the book would be too big. So it was purely to do with book length. Amazing. Stanislavski blew hot and cold over the decision. On the 23rd of April, he wrote to Ripsey expressing his doubts. He was afraid that the separate publication of the first part of the book as an actor's work on himself, one experience an actor prepares, concentrating on the psychological aspects of training, would give the appearance of an ultra-naturalistic bias if it were not properly linked to the physical aspects of acting. Physical characterization, incarnation, which would be to be dealt with in part two, and to work on the text, which was to be the subject of a later book. He therefore felt it important that the first volume should be prefaced by an outline of the system as a whole, an overview which would put all the different elements in their proper context and so avoid undue emphasis on the purely psychological. Unfortunately, such a preface was never written. And Stanislavski's fears were all too sadly confirmed by the subsequent history of the teaching of the system. Fascinating. Okay. The work completed. At the beginning of July, Stanislavski, Lilina and the Hapgoods returned to Baden-Wehle. Work continued. But when the Hapgoods left for the United States, they were not able to take a completed manuscript with them. On his return to the Soviet Union, Stanislavski once again found his collaborator, Mrs. Gurevich, and they set about revising the text. Unfortunately, Mrs. Gurevich was ill and overworked. She felt that she was being devoured by Stanislavski's book and had regretfully told him that she could not go on helping. She was not happy, in any case, with the semi-fictional form he had chosen. Without her help, Stanislavski was left alone to prevaricate and revise. His natural tendency to hesitation was reinforced by other external factors. First, he was once again under heavy ideological attack from the so-called left. The Stalinist period was producing its own form of crude, mechanistic materialism, and Stanislavski stood accused of idealism and biologism. His use of words such as the unconscious and the magic if were especially condemned. I'm not sure if Benedetti goes into it here, but of course this is around the time that Meyerhold was executed and his wife murdered because he gave a speech in support of formalism. So the stakes are incredibly high in the Soviet Union. That was me, by the way. Back to Benedetti. Stanislavski, who was always more concerned with practice than niceties of terminology, asked friends to help him develop a more Marxist vocabulary, but without success. Nonetheless, he was careful in the preface to the Russian edition of Actor's work on himself to deny any pretensions to scientific status for his ideas. Also, he had come to realise that the book, based as it was on experiences often dating from before the First World War, no longer represented his current view. Then he had started from the inner world, experience, emotion, memory. But now he began with the physical analysis of the action and of given circumstances. He would thus have liked to revise the book completely. But Elizabeth Hapgood was pressing him for a completed manuscript. He tinkered with the text, but left it substantially unaltered. It was important, moreover, to get on with part two if the essential connection between the psychological and the physical was to be established. An Actor's Work on Himself, one, was accordingly dispatched to the United States, 15 chapters in March and May 1935 and January 1936, the 16th not following until June 1936. Mrs. Hapgood discovered that the translation she had worked on in France and Germany was no longer usable. With the changes that had been introduced in the intervening period, the book, which had comprised 100,000 words in 1930, was now running to 175,000. She rapidly produced a new translation, but a disappointment awaited her. There was now a new chief editor at Yale University Press, and he rejected the book on the grounds that there were not a dozen people who would know what it was about. Other publishing houses expressed similar opinions. The book was simply not commercial. Mrs. Hapgood finally turned to Theatre Arts Book, a small house that had originally confined itself to bringing out the highly respected magazine Theatre Arts, but which had branched out into books in 1933 with Boleslavsky's Acting the First Six Lessons. Theatre Art Books was willing to accept an actor prepares on condition that cuts were made. Like Stanislavski's French translators, Edith Isaacs, the chief editor, found many passages too Russian. Stanislavski authorised Mrs. Hapgood to make cuts. He had little choice, but made it quite clear. Cuts, yes. Rewriting, no. Edith Isaacs, without consulting anybody, also made cuts. Mrs. Hapgood protested in private, but in public she affirmed that Edith Isaacs' cuts made Stanislavski's ideas stand out with jewel-like clarity. An Actor Prepares was published in New York in November 1936 and brought out the same year in London by Geoffrey Bless. The question of copyright was difficult. The Soviet Union had not signed the International Copyright Convention, and as a Soviet citizen, Stanislavski could not, therefore, acquire world copyright in his book. anyone could pirate his work. Determined to honour the agreement reached with Stanislavski in Menton and to protect Stanislavski's interests and those of his heirs, Mrs. Hapgood hit upon an ingenious but ultimately dangerous solution. While she is designated the translator in the contract signed with Theatre Arts Books, in registering the copyright she declared herself, with her husband, co-author. As an American citizen, she was able to acquire the copyright without difficulty. Maybe this is going to be a very long podcast, so maybe I'll break it in two. So the next section is called Death and Its Consequences, because everyone's going to die. Mrs. Hapgood's death, her husband is going to die, and then Stanislavski dies in 1938. So let's leave it there for the moment. So there you go. We've got to the publication of An Actor Prepares in America and in London. This is the edition that Michel Saint-Denis and John Gielgud and the Redgraves and everyone's going to read and is going to be, and I'm going to pick up in a bookshop in Dublin in the 1990s, the Hapgood translation. But next time, maybe tomorrow if I can get some time, we'll continue and finish the rest of this fascinating story, story of a book which I think you could probably argue has had at least as much effect on the history of the British Drama School as any other, perhaps more. Wonderful. So let's leave it there and keep an eye out. Soon I'll complete this story, A History of Stanislavski, in translation by Jean Benedetti. Take care. Talk to you soon. Bye.